Good morning. In her recently televised dystopian novel, The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood writes more than once that context is all, a familiar proposition to a judge assessing an issue of fact or interpreting a document. And so when discussing where the judiciary may be going in this post-referendum world, it's perhaps appropriate first to consider where the judiciary is coming from. Let me go back 150 years, 1867. Walter Badgett's classic work, The English Constitution, was published that year. Any reader would have concluded that the judiciary had no constitutional role and no significant public law role. There are chapters which cover the sovereign, cabinet, the legislature, and the executive, but there is no chapter on the judges. They're only mentioned in a couple of throwaway lines throughout the book. This reflects the fact that the constitutional function of the judges in the 19th century was low-key to the point of non-existent. The law reports of that time suggest that the public law role was largely restricted to construing legislation, normally exercised only in relation to local authorities. Moving forwards to three quarters of a century to 1941, Liversidge and Anderson illustrates how very reluctant judges still were to interfere with executive action. And that persisted in the years following the Second World War. In the 1947 Plymouth City Centre case, Lord Green, then Master of the Rolls, said that when deciding to make a compulsory purchase order, a minister was at liberty to base his opinion on whatever material he thinks fit, and the minister need not even inform the court as to what material he had relied on. In a judgment 6 months later, of course, the same Lord Green laid down the famous Wensbury test, but his definition of irrational or unreasonable was very restrictive. Namely, and I quote, so absurd that no sensible person could ever dream that it lay within the powers of the authority. But less than 30 years after Liversidge, the judicial worm was turning. The 1968 Annie's Minnick decision involved a statute which set up a commission to decide whether persons whose foreign property had been confiscated should be entitled to compensation. The Act specifically provided that any decision by the commission to accept or reject a claim could not be challenged in a court. The law lords nonetheless held that they could quash the commission's refusal to accept the appellant's claim because in making the decision, the commission had made an error of law which went to its jurisdiction. So in little less than a quarter of a century, their lordships had gone from holding that they could not interfere with a decision when the regulation concerned pretty plainly entitled them to do so, to holding that they could interfere with a decision when the relevant statute appeared expressly to forbid them from doing so. By the 1970s, and certainly by the 1980s, Lord Green would have been astonished at how judges were far more ready than he would have been to allow challenges to executive decisions, and even more astonished by the fact that they would almost routinely be relying on his Wensbury judgment to justify their decisions. This change in judicial approach was no doubt partly attributable to the difference between the conventional and respectful attitudes in the restrained and sober 1940s and the more questioning and irreverent zeitgeist in the exuberant and edgy 1960s. The change was also, I think, reinforced by what Robert Hughes called the culture of complaint, which had developed by the late 1980s. Also,